Hello, my name's Tom Walker. Welcome to That'll Be The Day. In this podcast, I'm going to be talking to a visually impaired probation officer who, by her own admission, is a stubborn old mule. But before we hear from Jill Wake, if you like the music at the start of this podcast, it's a track called That'll Be The Day by the Liverpool band The Vow. And as always at the end of my podcasts, I'll be featuring a track by the band. To find out which one it is, stay tuned. Jill Wake and I have a couple of things in common. Not only did we attend the same primary school, the Royal School for the Blind in Liverpool, but we have also worked with seriously dangerous offenders. In my case, in Old Course Prison in Liverpool, and in Jill's, as a probation officer for over 32 years. And as you might imagine, Jill has strong views on the challenges we visually impaired people face in the workplace. She also has a wealth of experience and stories to share. And there's a couple of very funny anecdotes in there too. I met Jill a couple of weeks ago at her home in Hoylake, near Liverpool.
I'm sitting with Jill Wake in one of her lounges. She has two, I think. And there's a cat and a retired guide dog here with us as well. So if you hear any extraneous noises, it will be them, I'm absolutely certain. Jill, we've known each other for a very long time.
We have indeed. I think it was probably about 8 when I first met you.
Wavertree Blind School.
Yeah.
I was sitting in what they called the little ones, and I remember you coming in.
I remember the classroom I was in and trying to get to grips with learning Braille. That's my sort of earliest memories. My main memories of meeting you was fighting with you in the playground.
I can't believe that. Well, we parted company at 11 before we share any more embarrassing memories. You went to Chorley Wood, yeah. And I went to Worcester College for the Blind. And you're now a probation officer. When did you first decide that you wanted to become a probation officer? Was it at Chorley Wood or did you have bigger, grander plans?
I think it's kind of started then. I remember sitting with the head teacher and her going through the 5 top jobs for blind people and saying probation wasn't on that list. And I thought, right, I'm not going to do any of those 5 jobs. I'm going to do something else. And I said to her, what about probation? And she said, oh, there's only one person that's ever done it in this country. And I said, well, it's no reason for me not to do it. So I then went to uni, went on a placement and just met someone who was actually a manager in the city centre and thought, you know what, this is dead interesting. Then when in my 3rd year at uni, I moved into my own accommodation near Sefton Park and one of the neighbours was a probation officer, so it was kind of meant to be, at least that's how it felt. So I started volunteering at the local office, then spent another 12 months working in victim support, which was really interesting because that gives you the other side of the coin, really, seeing the victims rather than the offenders. then went off and did the training programme.
Can you remember the 5 jobs that you were told you could go for at Chorley Wood? Because at Worcester, Worcester College for the Blind, it was, I think it was computer programming, teaching or the law.
We didn't actually have, the law wasn't included. It was definitely teaching, social work, telephony, good old days. Yeah, computer programming. And I don't know what the 5th one was, actually.
So you were at Liverpool University. What did you study? Was it sociology?
Yeah, sociology with a bit of psychology, yeah. Yeah.
And then after that, did you actually do a formal qualification then in probation? Or was the work experience and the volunteering sufficient?
It took me 3 years to get onto the training programme. So I was out of work for a year, feeling really sorry for myself. Then I went into victim support, which in those days was like a government-sponsored scheme in Liverpool 8, which really was an eye-opener for me. Used to get lads who were also on the scheme coming in trying to sell me stolen jewellery. And obviously I'm going out to see victims who've had the jewellery stolen. People are coming in trying to sell me the stuff. So that was quite interesting. Then I had another year of unemployment and then I applied. I think it took me 2 attempts to get onto the social work training course. So in those days, it was the postgrad course I did, a 12-month one, and they just kind of added on another module of criminal justice for probation.
So what was your first job once you'd qualified?
Right, once I qualified, I actually, the chief probation officer who offered me the job, we all started on the same day because in those days, he liked the intake to all start at the same time. And you used to have to go in the courts at the beginning to sort of cut your teeth. But because Liverpool Magistrates Court was so inaccessible, they decided that I could sit at home on full pay for 8 weeks while they found me a place, which was brilliant, actually. So yeah, they sent me to again to Liverpool 8 to work in the office there, just supervising a variety of cases. And again, that was a real tough start to the job for me. Within about 3 months, we had to move out of the office because it was declared unfit. It's cracking and collapsing. So I then had to go to like 3 or 4 different locations and still try and supervise the same people. So I found that quite difficult. One stage, we were supervising people in a school that was being converted while we were actually using it into a probation office. And I think my lowest point was sitting on a bag of cement trying to challenge someone about their offending behaviour with all these workmen. I was thinking, oh, God, you know, those are the days.
You've talked about supervising cases. Mm. I think for people who don't know or maybe have a hazy idea of what probation is, tell us what the job actually entails. What is the day-to-day work of a probation officer?
OK, well, there are different types of specialisms. The generic probation officer will supervise people in the community and linking with people who are serving prison sentences who will be coming out with some kind of supervision period. So they could be anything from what we call lower risk offenders. So they could be, you know, people who are addicted to drugs who maybe are committing offences to fund the habit, right up to people who are serving life sentences for, you know, for obviously murder, manslaughter, that sort of thing. Increasingly, there's a lot of people, certainly from when I started, I would say there's a huge number of people that we have to work with who have got mental health issues. You know, they're let down by the system in the early stages. They may be diverted from custody or from the criminal justice system at the beginning, but they're quickly sucked into the system. And because the lack of community resources, obviously, they end up, you know, in a revolving door, basically in and out of prison, serving short prison sentences. So they're really difficult to work with. And obviously, a lot of people who come out of prison are homeless. So it's about trying to link in with all those partnership agencies in the community as well. Again, I would say as a probation officer, you tend to supervise the sort of higher risk of harm people. So I would say the majority of people, before I worked in the courts, which is my current job now, writing pre-sentence reports, before that, most of my caseload would be people who've committed sexual offences or, you know, nasty domestic violence offenders. They would form the sort of majority of my caseload because they'd be seen as the highest risk in the community.
And when you qualified, was there any resistance to you as a visually impaired person from starting work?
Yeah, really tough. I mean, in those days, we were just starting to use computers. And obviously, my access to case files was really difficult. There was no such thing as support workers, all those sort of things. So I did struggle a lot. The manager that I had at the beginning was a newly qualified senior probation officer. So obviously he had his own things to grapple with, but he was actually really, really supportive. But the woman who actually was the person who qualified me, if you like, you're on probation yourself for 12 months. At the end of that 12 months, because of my access requirements and the building collapse and all those sort of things, I didn't jump through the hoops as high as they thought I needed to. And I can remember actually saying to me in a public meeting, stood by the tea trolley, you know, we'll extend your confirmation period for 6 months. We want you to be a proper probation officer, don't we, Jill? And I was absolutely gutted. I thought, how dare you say that to me? I actually kind of thought about leaving, because I'm such a stubborn old mule, I thought, right, I'm going to show you.
And so, you did, 32 years later.
I know, yeah.
How have attitudes changed towards you as a visually impaired person in those 32 years?
Well, it depends on what audience you're asking about. In terms of the clients or offenders that I work with, it's not actually made a great deal of difference, because I think one of the things about being in probation is people are so preoccupied with their own issues that they actually don't really care about yours.
Would you say they notice even, or they just don't care?
I think a bit of both, really. I mean, obviously, occasionally you'll get someone who says, oh, it's marvellous what you can do, and da, 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 da. And other people actually say, do you know what? After sitting here with you for an hour, I realise that my problems aren't really that important. And you kind of think it's a backhanded compliment in a sense, I guess. And I think, do you know what? If you walk out of here feeling better about yourself than when you came in, you know, that's fine. Life could be worse, it could be blind kind of thing, you know what I mean?
And what about your colleagues and the employer?
They've been more problematic. Colleagues, you'd think it would be the other way around. I mean, I can count on one hand the amount of times that clients have actually taken advantage of the fact that I can't see. And but with colleagues and management, obviously the structure of probation, it's got increasingly difficult, I would say. At the beginning, it was very difficult for obvious reasons, but in sort of more modern times, I think there's so much emphasis upon, you know, performance targets, ticking the right boxes, and obviously everything's, you know, online. And it's there've been times when it's actually been really difficult for me, and there've been times when I thought, oh, I can't do this anymore. But in the last few years, I've had really good support workers, and probation actually, instead of for years and years, they were digging their heels in and didn't want to sort of get directly involved in that. But in the last few years, they've actually financed the support worker themselves. So I've not had any involvement with Access to Work, which is such a relief.
Yeah, Access to Work is a real pain for all
of
us.
Yeah, it's so difficult. And this constant reassessment, and you think, nothing's changed. I'm doing the same job that I was doing 3 years ago. My access requirements are exactly the same as they were 3 years ago, but it seems to vary as to who assesses you, as to what you get. So I've had to fight quite a lot over the years to retain the support that I've needed.
Now, friends of mine who have done social work, particularly visually impaired friends, have commented on how inaccessible some of the software is on the IT systems. Has that been the same for you?
That has been the major issue for me in recent years, yeah. And because the workloads, I mean, compared to when I first joined, the workloads, you know, doubled, tripled even. And obviously we're much more accountable than we were 30 years ago. So it's about ticking the boxes in the right places. And there've been, I mean, about 5 years ago, I had what we call a serious further offence, which means someone that you're supervising who commits a nastier further offence. So it could be a murder or a sexual offence, a rape, something like that. And I had two in quick succession, having not had any all my career. And one of the issues that came out of that was that my recording was lacking, and I wasn't justifying what I was doing. I was doing the work face to face, but wasn't evidencing it on the computer. And obviously that was down to access requirements for me. But when it comes to a further offence, you know, and you get inspected from an independent, from the Home Office, you know, that isn't the paramount thing that they're looking at. They're looking at covering their backs, I suppose, you know, if I'm being very blunt about it. So that was a really difficult period for me as well.
And was that a software issue, do you think, as much as anything?
Yeah, that part of the criticism of that was definitely to do with access, yeah, because the system we use to record in probation is totally inaccessible with the, you know, JAWS, I use screen reader software. It's totally inaccessible So what I did in the end is I got a really sound support worker, and I get them to do all of that for me now. So I'm just doing the job, you know, I can assess, I can do the interviews, I can write stuff up, but the actual official uploading to the system, they do all that.
And your colleagues and management have no complaints since the support worker?
No, not at all. Because probation now are directly involved in hiring and firing, you know, the burden of that sort of responsibility is now theirs. And obviously, I have a say in who my support worker is, but they actually have the final decision.
They do the recruitment.
Yeah. Which for me, having gone through the mill with Access to Work over the years, it's actually a lot better.
Now, you and I have both been in employment since the advent of the Disability Discrimination Act, and then subsequently the Equality Act. Mm. Did they make any difference to how you work and the support you receive from the employer?
I'd like to say yes, but I actually don't think they did in depth. I mean, when the DDA came in, it obviously took a good few years for that to kick in, really, didn't it, for employers to actually sit up and use it properly. And there was a period when things got significantly better. So I went from not having any support at all to suddenly them wanting to offer support but not being really sure what support I needed. But, you know, at least they're on board, aren't they, and they're interested. But after the Equality Act, I feel like we've kind of gone backwards a little bit.
I agree with you entirely. Yeah, I think in many respects it's become even harder now.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's occurred to me, and I'd be interested in your thoughts in this, is in some respects we as visually impaired and disabled people have to justify ourselves more in employment and are often held to higher standards than our fully sighted, able-bodied colleagues.
Yeah, I think there's something in that. And I think one of the things, certainly in my experience, and it's probably quite a common experience, is that they rush to get you assistive technology or to get you the major access requirements sorted. And then it's kind of, oh, well, we've done that. What are you complaining about? What is it that you're still finding difficult? And I think what they find very difficult because of targets and performance and pressures of from senior management is that regardless of all these things in place, the job still takes me a bit longer. And it doesn't matter, you know, what magic wand they can wave at me. It's still going to take that bit longer to do everything. And sometimes that gets overlooked because of the pressures they're under. You know what I mean? It all trickles down to the bottom, doesn't it?
Yes, it's usually the most junior member of staff who ends up copping for any mistakes, isn't it?
Yeah.
In any organisation, quite
that's
honestly.
Right. Yeah.
Now, one of the other things we've got in common, as well as having attended Wavertree Blind School, is that we've both worked with serious offenders. Mm. I did some work in Alt Course, and I was interested to know how you feel when, you know, you're sitting there in front of somebody who's committed a serious offence. Because when I was doing some work in Alt Course, I was sitting in a room on my own with armed robbers and people doing all sorts of stuff. And nobody told me where the emergency button was or anything like that. I just kind of sat there.
Yeah.
And I'm not complaining about that because I enjoyed the work. But I was wondering how you felt, not only as a visually impaired person, but as a woman.
Mm.
You know, when you're in a room and you kind of know that you're with somebody who would be categorised as really quite dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, it is a major issue. Obviously, health and safety is paramount. But in my experience, I can probably count on one hand the amount of times I've been actually frightened when I've been with somebody. Most people, again, I don't know whether it's me being female and being small or whether it's being disabled, but generally, most people actually treat you with respect and they'll actually challenge other people for having a go at you. Interestingly, and I've actually used that to my advantage because you've got to use every tool in the box.
You have.
I don't come across as a poor, vulnerable female, but I'll certainly respond to how, you know, someone is how you sort of you get a gut feeling, obviously, after a long time of what someone's issues are. And I mean, statistically, for example, people who commit murder are far less risky than someone who perhaps is committed a theft from person on the street when they've been under the influence of coke. You know what I mean? So it's about making those assessments about who is a threat to you. And obviously when you're challenging people and they've used drugs, there've been moments when it has been quite difficult. But as I say, generally, most people have been pretty fair. And as I say, the people that you need to be most fearful of in my role is when you don't know someone's background and you're actually uncertain as to what buttons you're going to press. You know, if I go into that area of conversation, is that going to trigger a violent reaction? I've been probably only one occasion actually in the probation office where someone's actually stood up and gone to hit me. And again, you just talk people down. You know, I tend to sort of let people vent for a little bit rather than trying to challenge them straight away and tell them to sit down and shut up. I'll let them vent a bit and allow them to not to be in control of a situation, but to allow them to so they think that they've been heard and they can air the grievances. And then I'll say very quietly, okay, you know, I'll give you my opinion now. Let's talk this through and try and work out a way if you're dealing with this issue. Because most of the time it's people's frustration and their inability to sort of deal with authority. It's not a personal thing. You just happen to be the authority sat in front of them.
One of the things I've done in Alt Courses is help with communications.
Mm.
And I've often wondered, and you'll be an interesting person to ask this question too, whether actually it's communication failures often lead to people committing other offences. I know there are other background issues as well, but often talking to the guys, you can often tell that communication is a big, big issue with them and for them.
Oh, definitely. I mean, again, you know, people go to prison and unfortunately they tend to, in most situations in the last few years, certainly, they're locked up, they're given recreation, they're locked up again. And that sort of education rehabilitation is you know, can be quite poor at times. And particularly for younger people as well, that they're sort of putting up a front, they're pretending they're not scared of being in custody. they find it, they tend to shut down to survive anyway. And it's very difficult if you have got emotional issues to actually deal with those in the custodial setting. It's far more difficult than in the community.
I was going to ask you about any funny incidents, because there must have been a few. I'll tell you mine. It's not visual impairment related. I told this guy that we were doing some interview training, and he said, "Bloody hell, mate." He said, "The last time I was interviewed, I got 12 years, which I thought was quite a sharp response. Yeah. I'm guessing you've got many more funny stories, and maybe you could share.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I'm just trying to think. I mean, one of the things, funny things in terms of my visual impairment that's happened made me realise how good my guide dog was at the time. Remember that I interviewed this lad, probably the first or second time I'd met him, very complex, quite a dangerous person. And we're sitting there in the room and he's saying to me, "Oh, I need to go to the toilet, I need to go to the toilet." I said to him, "Okay then, go." Anyway, I'm sitting there waiting for him, no sign of him. And I thought, that's strange. Anyway, I wander back into reception and I didn't actually realise he'd collapsed in reception. He's lying flat out on the floor. My dog just kind of takes me round him, you know. Next thing, all these paramedics came and I got ribbed for ages about that because I just kind of stepped over him and was totally oblivious to the fact that
he didn't know what you were stepping over.
Collapsed on the floor, yeah.
Presume that was drugs related.
Yes, yeah. He'd obviously taken something before he'd darkened my door, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's loads. I mean, there's another a lad who used to sell the Big Issue in Liverpool, and I did a report for him. I can't even remember now what he was in court for. And every time I walked past him for about 12 months, he used to go, "That's my probation officer. She did a really good report for him." I think, why tell the whole shopping, you know, community in Liverpool? You'd think he'd be ashamed, you know.
I guess he felt he had nothing to lose and maybe just wanted to thank you.
Yeah, well, that's true, yeah. And then another Big Issue seller always used to try and give me a pound when I walked past him as well. That's quite funny.
You kept him out of prison.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
I mean, visually impaired people these days are many more careers available, but some may be thinking of probation as a possible career. I mean, what would you say to them? What advice would you give a visually impaired person who's thinking of probation?
I think at the moment, going into probation at the moment, it's probably more stressful for other reasons rather than just, you know, having access requirements. It's very demanding, it's very challenging now, and there's a lot more academic work. When I trained, I was at university. I did two placements, but now it's on the job training. And it's very demanding. And I would suggest if anyone's thinking of doing it, you definitely need to talk to someone who's involved in the job and has some understanding of access requirements. We have a national team that, you know, supports people with disability in the service. And it'd definitely be worth speaking to someone from that organisation. They're independent. They're there to support colleagues and obviously to advise management as well, so they would be the go-to people, I think, to sort of talk through what the hurdles might be, because it's far best if you can actually be prepared, you know, because sadly there's still quite a lot of ignorance, really. So if you're starting a new job, you can't expect your line manager to actually know what the access requirements might be for you, so it's far better going well prepared, I would say.
What have you learnt about yourself, and in particular how you handle your visual impairment over the past 30 odd years?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think it's made me not see it as a barrier in many respects, in terms of communication, working with people, problem solving. Obviously the IT is the biggie, isn't it? All the way through my career, I've been involved in the sort of politics of disability within the probation service. So I've been in quite a good place in terms of challenging people, not personally about my access requirements, but other people's access requirements. And it's actually given me a lot more confidence to actually know what it is I need. So I've always been in quite a good place, apart from those very early days of actually knowing what I need to ask for and actually going with creative solutions rather than just saying, "This is a problem, what we're going to do about it." Because I've learned hard lessons that you don't get answers very quickly and you've got to come up with the solutions and then package it in a way that is you know, palatable for management to say, "Oh, yeah," and let them think that they've come up with the idea. That's always the key, I think.
You mentioned there the politics of disability, and there is a bit of a rebel about you, isn't there?
Yeah, I'm a stubborn old mule. And if someone says you can't do that, I'll make bloody well sure that I'll do it.
Is that compatible, though, with being a probation officer? Because I always imagine probation officers are pillars of the establishment, you know. They wouldn't do anything wrong.
No.
They wouldn't challenge anything. Go on, disabuse me.
Well, I think you have got to be really determined and you've got to be very thick-skinned because, obviously, all the people I work with don't want to work with me. So, you know, it's not a job for do-gooders, really. As I say, maybe at the beginning when I first joined probation, there was some of that. There's still a lot of welfare emphasis. But these days, that's all evaporated for, well, I won't go down that road. Don't get me started. But the job isn't what I went in to do. So I think, you know, there's very little positive reward. So you have got to be pretty tough and pretty resilient.
Great. I think we covered everything I want to cover there. Kept you talking for quite a while. We've had the dog snoring there in the background.
Put him to sleep.
He's gone to sleep. I hope the people listening to this don't fall asleep.
So do I.
Well, Jill, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you for talking to me, Tom.
Okay, to the music. Well, having just spoken to a probation officer who keeps the wheels of justice turning, there could only be one foul track, couldn't there? Wheels within wheels.
He calls and you while you stare, he steals and then talks in terms of salvation. All in good time, all in good taste. And now your broken sets in motion, wheels within wheels. Wheels within wheels, wheels within wheels, wheels within wheels. We know, and you're so young. Come on, come on. You say you need a friend to keep your peace of mind to the end. Come on down, come on down to the bottomless pit of my heart, to the murky depths of my soul. I'm asking you to give me a start. I'm telling you to let us go. You paint us all so black. He smiles, we all laugh. That smile, it's like a photograph. And we talk when we are told to. Talk in good faith, all in good taste. The constant winding, binding, grinding wheels within wheels, wheels within. Come on, come on. You
black.